It is a very tough time to be a big box store in America. There was the demise of Bon-Ton and Toys R Us last year. There are retailers right now that are teetering on the brink of collapse. Think Kmart and Sears. This week, our eye is on the situation inside Shopko, based in the Green Bay area. A bankruptcy could be just around the corner as it shutters dozens of stores nationwide, including seven here in Wisconsin. We're talking about it on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Jeff Bollier is a reporter at Press Gazette Media covering business in the Green Bay area, including the Shopko story. Jeff, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me on, Kate.
Well, let's start with the latest on this possible bankruptcy situation that seems to hasn't materialized yet. There was talk that the company would file for bankruptcy protections yesterday.
Yesterday was the day we were kind of watching to see if something came through federal bankruptcy courts, but nothing as of yet. Still trying to contact company officials to find out a little bit more about exactly what is going on.
So, but a bankruptcy doesn't exactly mean an end for the company, though.
No, it definitely does not, and it is, you know, to be clear, it is not, you know, any foregone conclusion that it will go this way. The company could be bought by another equity firm or another retailer, or it could find a way to reorganize on its own and start attacking its shortcomings as a retailer and try to emerge from this.
Shopko is a company with deep Wisconsin roots, and it emerged in 1962. I found the same year as Kmart came on the scene. What can you tell us about the company's history here?
Shopko was founded in Green Bay. It was a Chicago pharmacist, as you know, James Rubin, who opened the first one here on Green Bay's west side in 1962, and it really has become or has been a Wisconsin retailer since then. You know, a few periods where it went through private acquisition by SuperValue, which is a supermarket chain based out of Minneapolis, at one point, but then it was taken public in 1991. So it really has had kind of an up and down history here in the state as it grew and expanded, but retailers, people in the industry have told me that its reputation has always been one that it was, reliable, provided good service, and was not a retailer that you kind of went up against if you were a competitor without knowing what you were doing or what you were getting into.
Yeah, it's really been the heartbeat of some smaller towns, small communities. I was in Morris, Minnesota not too long ago, and it used to be Pomida there, and it had changed to Shopko, so it's had some acquisitions as well.
Very much so. It did acquire Pomida at one point, and that kind of really expanded its footprint and also gave rise really to its hometown type store, which is in these smaller towns. The community of Seymour, Wisconsin, announced or confirmed last week that its Shopko hometown was going to be closing. But, and as you said, a lot of these communities, where Shopko did try and push into and open stores, it was the only pharmacy in town. And so many of these communities are, in Nebraska, in South Dakota, in Minnesota, and states further west are trying to do what they can to let Shopko know that they'd really appreciate it if their stores could stay open.
We're going to be looking at that pharmacy situation in just a moment. Jeff Bollier is with us. He's a business reporter at Press Gazette Media. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is the Shopko store in your community closing? And if so, will you miss it? Do you rely on it for your prescriptions or other purchases? Perhaps you work at a shop Wapco? If so, let's hear from you at 800-642-1234. You can share what your situation is like, your connection to Shopco. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Jeff, how many people does Shopco currently employ?
So Shopco, recent court filings kind of have indicated that Shopco has about 15,000 employees across its 26-state footprint. About 5,000 of those are in Wisconsin, and here in Brown County, where Shopco is headquartered, documents have indicated, or the Greater Green Bay Chamber of Commerce has indicated, they have about 1,100 employees here locally in the Green Bay community, or in the Green Bay area.
So there are certainly a number of jobs that are at stake, especially as we see about 39 or so stores nationwide closing. What is the number again?
We're up to, with another six stores that were announced, are confirmed last week in Wisconsin, we're up to closer to 45 stores that we've been able to identify that will be closing between the end of February and early April.
Can we look more specifically at Shopco's struggles in recent years and the struggles for brick and mortar for these big box stores in general? What has Shopco been up against?
Shopco has been facing what a lot of these retailers, you had mentioned Bon-Ton, stores you had mentioned Kmart and Sears, are up against also, and that is that where they used to be sort of a department store, a general retailer with a little bit of everything, that sort of market has been eaten into on all sides. It's not just online or internet sales, but retail officials or experts have kind of told me that it's also everything from other big boxes, Walmarts and Myers, where price rules, and then also though convenience stores, dollar stores, which are rapidly growing in number and expanding across communities. So everybody is kind of trying to eat a little bit of market share from these sort of established general retailers, and the impact has been what I would describe kind of as a death of a thousand cuts, where it's not just one thing that you could point to, but multiple sort of things that have compounded over years and years as the retail industry has slowly started to change.
Now, we always look to Amazon. It sounds like there have been a number of factors that are really, as you say, eating at the edges of Shopco's bread and butter business here. And perhaps not having a little bit of everything is really the best focus. How openly has the company been about talking about its latest situation and about its situation and its bottom line?
Well, it has not been very vocal or very forthcoming with information right now. Trying not to speculate too much about why or what is fueling that, but we certainly have been among the different media outlets that have been asking, the company kind of for reaction to some of the lawsuit that it was filed against it in Brown County Court last week that kind of sparked some of these discussions and some of these store closures, like what the future holds. And so we're still pursuing that, but there hasn't been too much information that they have provided as of yet.
Towns across Wisconsin have wanted to find out if their Shopco will be liquidated. We're looking at the situation with Jeff Bollier. He's a business reporter at Press Gazette Media. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you rely on Shopco, perhaps for prescriptions or other purchases? Is it part of your community? Join the conversation. We'll be back after a news update, or in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. One headline yesterday: what happens to Shopco Plaza in Menasha without Shopko. The answer, developers are doing a $3 million facade remodel and renaming it Menasha Marketplace. Communities are wondering if Shopko is pulling out of their own town as we see 45 Shopkos closing nationwide. We're looking at the prospects here with Jeff Bollier, who is with us on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Jeff is a business reporter at Press Gazette Media, following the Shopko developments. Getting your reactions and insights at 800-642-1234. Are you surprised that Shopko is hurting? Is Shopko a fixture in your town? Is it closing? And where will you go now? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Sue now, joining us from Grafton. Hi, Sue.
Hi. Our Grafton store is closing, and I was so bummed when I saw that this weekend. You can get the best Packer clothes there, you know, being based in Wisconsin, and it was so wonderful, and I'm so going to miss it.
So where will you go for your Packers clothes and other purchases?
I'm not quite sure yet. I think there's still a Shopko in Sheboygan, but you'll have to go to the other store set. That's how it's going to have to be.
Sue, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Michelle now in Stevens Point. Michelle, your thoughts.
Hi. So we actually have two Shopkos within like about a 15-minute driving distance of each other. One of them, you can definitely tell, got a nice little facelift. It looks really nice when you go inside. It feels a little bit like a department store. And the other one, the one that's closest by me, is pretty run down. It reminds me a lot of Kmart. That was also in our town that ended up leaving. The other thing I've noticed is that the prices there are nearly double the price of, like, other, because we have two other competitors very close to each other. And so I find myself only going there if I absolutely need something that day. Another thing is I feel like the internet especially, they haven't really kept up with their online services in the way other retailers have kind of stepped up to the plate. And I feel like that's definitely impacting any of their services.
I feel like it
might be something that I might go down to the other Shopko to get some stuff, but definitely I try and stay away from the one that's not really looking so hot. It just feels really sad in there.
Michelle is bringing up a bunch of points here. Jeff Bollier, what are you hearing?
Hearing that, nothing coming out of Point yet. Michelle, the nice one with the facelift should be staying open for the time being right now. Sue does make a good point also that, it is a bummer that some of these stores are closing as in communities with a few less options. It was becoming the only option, as some of that contraction happened. I haven't done much shopping on Shopko's online website, much like Michelle was talking about, it's kind of that store that I think of when it's like, well, we haven't had success finding this somewhere else, or, if we need it right away, like, let's check out Shopko, let's just run by there and see. So it kind of has walked that line of both that department store, but also the value retailer. Michelle kind of mentioned too.
Michelle brings up also that different price points at different stores, is that common in retail?
It is hard to tell. As just a sort of consumer on my own, I have noticed sometimes a difference in prices, where a retailer, if you want to go into a brick and mortar store, this book or this device is this much, but then if you go on their website, it is significantly less, or there is a discounted price. And sometimes that is just a reflection of the competition in the market, and other times it is something else that I wish I understood better.
I noticed that this weekend buying cat food in store, in the brick and mortar store, it was $5 more than on their website. And that's a pretty big difference.
Yeah, it is, and it's one of those head scratchers that, that product is in theory, the same price, but also, brick and mortar stores do have some additional costs that do come with it sometimes. you know, but they still do, I think, serve a market and a demand from shoppers for that, you know, who for whom even, you know, two day free shipping isn't gonna be, you know, be enough or get it there soon enough.
Let's talk about Shopko pharmacies, because that's a big part of their business. What's going on with that aspect of the business?
A lot of their pharmacy locations have been sold out of their stores. Starting in December, my colleagues at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel started breaking the news that that Shopko pharmacies, which were, you know, kind of an earlier innovation or development that the company had done, you know, going back to the early 1970s, putting pharmacies in their stores, that a lot of those businesses where there was a Pick and Save or a Metro Market location, you know, Kroger Company, Pick and Save's parent, had bought the business and bought sort of the customer lists and from Shopko recently. Hy-Vee did the same thing in southeastern Wisconsin, I believe into Iowa and some of that area. Then CVS had also acquired several Shopko pharmacy businesses in Wisconsin and I believe Illinois also as well. So those pharmacies have largely closed over the last week to 10 days, and probably those customers should have been contacted by those pharmacies about new procedures or getting the information transferred over.
Let's go to Caitlin now, joining us from Taylor's Falls, Minnesota. Caitlin, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Caitlin.
What's on your mind?
My family relies on our local Shopko in North Branch, Minnesota, to get our glasses because my mother wears them, my stepfather, my brother, myself, my younger sister. Like, it's very important in our family to have the glasses, and I've heard a lot of rumor in our community that one will be closing, but I'm not for sure either.
Well, Caitlin, thank you for the call, and I'm sorry, Kate.
No, go. Jeff, go ahead.
I will certainly try and contact the company, Caitlin, and see if I can find out a little bit more about the location there in North Branch, Minnesota.
And certainly in the eye care business as well, because that's another branch, another type of spin-off within the business, and there's customer data in there as well.
Very much so, and I am glad that you and Caitlin brought this up, Kate, because that is a huge business that we're still trying to kind of figure out what is going on with or what will happen to that. But it appears that the optometry locations, while the pharmacy business has been sold, they continue to operate in the individual Shopko stores still. And that is a business that, is sort of separately owned but still under the Shopko umbrella.
Let's go to Jeff in Appleton with thoughts. Jeff, hi.
Hello. I guess I'm kind of shocked to find out that people are shocked by the closing of Shopko, or the closings in Shopko. The prices at Shopko are almost across the board higher than everybody else's, yet you still can't find anybody to help you within the store. People are willing to pay a premium price, but there's got to be service with it. And with the gutting of the service and the employees within the store, there's no value to paying the extra cost within Shopko.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Service is key there, and he thinks it's coming up short, Jeff.
That is something that I have, you know, is going to go from store to store. I can't really, say one way or another. But, yeah, I mean, what Jeff is talking about is very true also, though, that, you know, customer service demands and, needing or want, you know, when we need or want help, is certainly something that retail has to be sharp on, or, the consumer will definitely have plenty of options to pursue elsewhere, either online or, within You know, as Jeff was talking about Appleton, there's quite a few different choices that they can make, you know, in a community like Appleton.
Do you think a lot of other retailers are watching the Shopko situation with interest?
I think so. You know, I mean, the retail industry, you know, as you kind of mentioned at the beginning of the hour, was, you know, has been dealing with a lot of bankruptcies and a lot of reorganizations, a lot of sort of very huge names that, you know, that blazed the trail a century or more ago in the retail industry are, you know, kind of facing tough times and wondering where they go from here. And so, you know, that I think is kind of translating here too.
Well, Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, Kate, thank you very much for having me, and I appreciate all the calls from the callers. It's you know, it's a good reminder of how important these stores are, you know, to different you know, two communities, large and small, and you know, so.
Jeff Beliar is a reporter at Press Gazette Media covering business in the Green Bay Area. Up next, it's news and then a look at cities building on top of industrial sites. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In all cities, there is churn. There's industrial churn, residential churn, relic waste. And we're going to find out what those terms mean as we look at what happens when the factories and large manufacturing facilities go dark. There are urban lots where hazardous industrial facilities once operated but no longer do. In some cities, what springs up in their place on these coveted land parcels is these hip neighborhoods and redevelopment projects that seize on that old factory vibe. And that's a vibe that could have lurking hazards in the soil, in the walls, in the air. And the redevelopment is a world away from the original use of that land. So a pair of sociologists have a new book out. It's called Sites Unseen, Uncovering Hidden Hazards in American Cities. And they met as graduate students here at UW-Madison. Jim Elliott is professor and department chair of the Department of Sociology at Rice University. Jim, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thank you.
And Scott Frickle is a professor of sociology and environment and society at Brown University. Scott, welcome to you.
Thanks, Kate. Great to be here.
Well, Scott, let's start with you. Many urban areas share a common past that may be hidden after decades of change. One is industry and manufacturing. How is that part of what makes urban areas tick?
You know, industrial growth is really sort of hardwired into the history of American cities, small and large. Industry is what makes a lot of cities' economies chug along. And so when you begin to look deeply and seriously at the sort of fine-grained patterns of industrial the ebbs and flows of industrial growth in and through and around cities, we begin to see something about, and our hope in this project was to learn something about how cities actually work by studying, you know, a major feature of urban economic development and growth.
And you got really granular on these industrial sites, really digging into the data sets that are out there to figure out where these sites are and then what's on top of them today.
Right. So the book or the study is really based on a sort of a new approach or methodology that Jim and I developed that makes very systematic use of state historical manufacturing directories. And these are directories that exist in most states for most years, dating back at least to the early 1950s. And they're really compendiums of manufacturing facilities that were operating in a state in a given year. And so for this project, we went and hit the books, so to speak, and found and extracted data from these old manufacturing directories in four cities: New Orleans, Minneapolis, Portland, Oregon, and Philadelphia. For every other year from the early 1950s until about 2008, when we stopped collecting data. And by doing that, we get, as you said, a very fine-grained picture that begins to come into view about what kinds of industries are operating in cities at particular times, where they are located, and for how long they operate in a particular place or on a particular parcel of land. By aggregating data from these directories, we can see that these patterns begin to emerge. There's spatial patterns and temporal patterns about how industrial development actually plays out over time and across space.
Jim, what are the challenges? What are your concerns that come up with having an industrial past and building on that and using parcels in a completely different way?
Right. Well, this gets back to some of the larger points that Scott was getting to. So en route to that, answering that question, it's important to realize what we do is look at cities oftentimes as places, but again, realizing that those are processes. The things in Madison, the things in Houston, Providence, are constantly going on. And one of the things that we uncovered before we got to the parcels was this realization that, you know, every year in the United States, just the reported hazardous waste that's released to land on site at points of production is over 1 billion pounds. And that doesn't include mining or other extractive industries. And so what we have in cities with the churning that Scott was talking about is a changing of where people live, but also a changing of where industry is located. And if the average churn for a hazardous industrial facility is only 8 to 10 years and then it goes away and then gets occupied by something else, what it's doing is not just changing who's occupying that land, but it's fundamentally changing that parcel and that land, potentially, you know, leaving unknown toxins and contaminants behind. So what we wanted to do is begin to sort of really take that seriously in a way that government reporting hasn't. And so one of the things that you asked is, well, in taking that seriously, you know, it's useful to go and find out who and what is on that parcel now. And this gets into the broader processes that we wanted to talk about. So we use these state manufacturing directories that Scott talked about to identify exact addresses of hazardous industry over the past 50, 60 years. And then we went back in these four cities to sample a number of these sites and see what they had become, to see if, in fact, you would sit there or at the corner and say, yes, that's a site that deserves attention. It looks like it might pose a problem. And what we found was exactly the opposite, that, you know, we would go and find a child care facility or a mosque or a park, anything and everything that typically did not raise concern. And then from our industrial database, we were able to then go back and see that a lot of the hazardous facilities that we had identified occupying those spaces had actually ceased operation before any registration or policy denoting them as hazardous. So we have this huge blind spot historically, and the current vision is one that doesn't invite investigation. And so what we're trying to do with the site surveys that you mentioned is go out and see how ubiquitous and how hidden these things become, not just because they're buried in the soil, but because what's above it sort of erases our memory of what was there. And as neighborhoods change and as people move in and out of that space, they're unlikely to have a memory of what used to be there and raise concern. And so this gets into the broader process of change that we see going on, but oftentimes don't fully understand.
Talking with Jim Elliott and Scott Frickle, they're professors, and their new book is Sites Unseen, Uncovering Hidden Hazards in American Cities. And you can join the conversation, 800-642-1234. Do you live in an urban area with the history of manufacturing? What do you know about it? What concerns do you have about the cleanup or any waste left behind? And what do you want cities to do when it comes to managing their industrial history, their industrial footprint that's left behind? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Scott, cities we live in, they grow, they develop, as we just hear, they're always in process. What is driving this urban change?
Well, you know, the key mechanism for the sort of urban change that we're studying in this book is the use and reuse or redevelopment of urban land. So, you know, cities are fundamentally land-based. You know, we would, in sociology, we call them social formations, right? And land is fundamental to what cities are, what cities become. And so we are studying how land use changes over time and how different land uses are organized different spatially. That is, do they spread out? Do they contract? Do they follow routes of transportation or natural formations like rivers or topography in certain ways? And so those are the kinds of questions we're able to sort of dig into with this project. But it's really that at the heart of this book, and we argue at the heart of the nature of cities, is land use change.
And so when you looked at these four cities, New Orleans, Philadelphia, known as the manufacturing capital of the U.S., Portland, and Minneapolis, why those cities?
We wanted to get the study to be as generalizable as possible, given the sort of high demand for a very intensive data collection that we were undertaking in this project. And so our goal was to select four cities that are in different parts of the country, that are different sizes, have different kinds of racial and ethnic compositions. But all are relatively old cities, all have a history of industrial activity, and all, importantly, we think, are river port cities. And our logic there was that historic river port cities would be places where industrial processing would concentrate. And so that we were trying to find areas or cities that would sort of help us illustrate these questions that we were posing in this book. And so, what's interesting about the comparison that we undertake in this project is by looking at different cities in different regions and finding very similar patterns across all four of them, we can begin to sort of think more generally about the processes that we've uncovered in this project.
And here's what we know about big cities. They suck up a lot of resources. Consider megacities, populations of 10 million or more. Reading in the book, in 1990, there were 10 around the world, topped by Tokyo, Osaka, and New York. By 2030, the number is expected to increase to more than 40. So concentrating more of our activity and waste into fewer places. The book is called Sites Unseen, Uncovering Hidden Hazards in American Cities. We're taking a closer look at urbanization with sociologists Scott Frickel and Jim Elliott as our guides, getting your thoughts on cities as they redevelop. 800-642-1234. Do you live in an urban area with a history of manufacturing? Let's talk about it. Call in, email. We'll pick up the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. You're with us on the morning show as we talk about urbanization. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So the story goes that between 2009 and 2011, sociologists Scott Frickel and Jim Elliott, they took a series of field trips to Minneapolis, to New Orleans, Philadelphia, Portland, to see for themselves. They surveyed the modern land uses where complex factories and industrial sites once ruled the land, and they were armed with database research and lots of maps, but they were on a kind of a detective hunt to learn exactly what had become of old industrial lots. Their book is Sites Unseen, Uncovering Hidden Hazards in American Cities. And your questions and insights on rezoning, on placemaking, on urbanization, all welcome. 800-642-1234. How has industry affected the city where you live? What about the social and environmental health of the area? Do you live in an urban area with a history of manufacturing? And what do you want to know about it? 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Let's go to Mark now, joining us from Wauwatosa. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. How are you guys doing today?
Good.
Well, as I was explaining when you first took the call, I'm an environmental consultant. I've been doing it for about 30 years. And part of the process of property transactions is environmental due diligence. So typically, you know, when an industrial property or even a small commercial, you know, even as small as a gas station gets sold or transferred over to a party for redevelopment, there's typically a process that's called environmental due diligence, which begins with a phase one and oftentimes a phase two environmental property assessment. And so a lot of the properties that I've worked on as a consultant, you know, there is a process that we go through before the transaction is even, you know, consummated, the deal is even consummated, in order to fulfill the obligations of protecting the human health and the environment, which is, you know, one of the DNR here in Wisconsin, one of the DNR's requirements, that, you know, we make sure that the soil issues are managed, the vapor issues are managed, the groundwater issues are managed before, you know, any development takes place. And so my question is, have you taken those factors into consideration as part of your study?
Mark, great question. Jim, do you want to field this?
I'll start and see if Scott can fill in if he wants to. But Mark, thanks for your question. It's a great one. And I guess I would first go back and sort of contextualize the issue and then come forward to the present day. So one of the things we're concerned about is blind spots, that we don't really know the extent of the problem. And so in the early 80s, as you're well aware, there were federal regulations that came on board after Love Canal and other concerns about relevant contaminant waste and soils that said, hey, we need to pay more attention to this. So there were some federal laws and some new reporting requirements for industry, and that starts in the 80s, but there are holes in that, right? So only larger facilities have to report. It only begins in the 1980s. And then when there are violations to be inspected as we move into issues of, say, Superfund declarations, it's only the larger sites that become obviously sort of targeted for more intensive regulation. So I'm getting to your question, but it's a whole series of processes by which we begin, we think, from our investigations, that the regulations that are on the books and the processes tend to focus on a very small percentage of sites that maybe deserve attention. And so when we go and look at our database that just goes from the 1950s up to the present on all these sites that might be ones of concern because of lingering contaminants, we find that the records we look at, only about 1 to 10% of sites actually have some sort of public record of the testing you're talking about. And so that means the vast majority, 90 to 95%, are not being inspected. And so we think that's an issue. And so we're very glad for people like you and for the processes that work to identify those sites. But we think that they're too little in the big scope. People are doing good work, but they're just not the resources that have been sort of dedicated to doing the type of due diligence that you're talking about across the full sweep of sites. And that's certainly true before sites, you know, sites that might have gone out of business before the 1980s where there's not a lot of records of this. So our concern is sort of scoping out the processes and the testing that you're talking about to a fuller sweep of things. And maybe if you're going to talk about what we do is, you know, developing a policy that we might think of as a more ostrich policy. Go stick your head in that sand, in that soil, and figure this stuff out. And not you personally, but a bigger sort of, you know, cadre of folks looking out for the public interest.
Scott, I want you to jump in there on this ostrich policy. What could be changed in our current regulatory practices?
Well, let me follow on with what Jim was saying just very quickly. This is a really important issue, something that we address towards the end of our book. But Mark, it's true that we don't actually investigate the. In any systematic way, the kind of investigation, the phase one, phase two site investigations that go on at point of sale. And I guess I want to make two points about that. One is that part of what we're uncovering in this book is what we describe as industrial churning, or the churning of land uses. And our data suggest that over the course of over the span of the six decades that we cover in this study, a single site could undergo as many as four or five different land use changes in that period of time. So my concern, our concern, is really, as it relates to your question and the question of the site investigations, is what would trigger a site investigation. Certainly a gas station turning into a preschool would trigger a site investigation in anybody's book. But what about a gas station that went out of business in 1960 and became a hardware store and then became something else and then became a nursery school? It's not at all clear that those sorts of properties would trigger the kind of attention that you're talking about. The second point, though, and I think this is just a general point, is that the investigations that happen at points of sale occur within the context of a private or semi-private real estate market. Our understanding is that a lot of those investigative reports that are generated during those processes are not public or at least are not easily accessible by the public. And so it's a really murky world, the world of environmental consulting. It's structured by current regulations, and I guess our project raises questions about whether or not those legal structures are doing the kind of intensive work that the industrial churning in our study suggests is necessary. We don't have an answer to that question, but it's certainly the topic of a new study.
Of a healthy new study, right?
Right.
Jim, based on your work, what is your view then on the future of cities? What do we need to do while being mindful of our industrial past?
Right. Well, that's a great question. And as we found in our book, there are a number of people who are doing different things at the local level. So the response is going to be multi-layered from the federal to the state to the local level. And what we're trying to do is first, point to an obvious sort of fact, which is it's hard to deal with a problem you don't know about. So the book is really geared towards developing this new methodology that we've been talking about to track these sites and the reuse over time. And it's through this publicly available data source, these state manufacturing directories that have been produced in every state since the 1950s. So in the back of the book, if I can plug that, there is a do-it-yourself guide for how local communities or neighborhoods might go ahead and do something that we did in these four cities, in their own neighborhoods or cities, and begin to identify where sites of concern might be. So that's one place to begin to develop it. And as Scott mentioned, the other is to sort of bring this stuff out of sort of the gray area of the market. I have family members who have bought property on the East Coast, and part of their agreements are that they will basically not do certain things. They'll acknowledge the waste or the contaminants, but ask the owners not to dig and do these sorts of things. So we need less of a circumscribed private solution to this and more of a neighborhood coming up to a city, state, and federal level.
Thank you so much for joining us. Jim Elliott is professor and department chair of the Department of Sociology at Rice University. Scott Frickel is a professor of sociology and environment and society at Brown University. They're the authors of Sites Unseen, Uncovering Hidden Hazards in American Cities, as we've been exploring old industrial sites and what is built on top of them. Just ahead, Indigenous History contains a series of injustices. We'll talk about it. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.